Hello, and welcome to episode 179 of the 21st Century Work-Life Podcast, where we talk about how the world of work and our attitudes to work are changing. In this episode, Robert Glaser, founder and CEO of Acceleration Partners, talks about building culture in a distributed company. Then Maya and I talk about a range of experiments and initiatives going on in the world, focusing on reducing the number of hours employees spend at work. So we've only got two segments in today's episode, but they're relatively long in comparison to some of what we've been doing recently, and they're very detailed. So I think there will be plenty for today's episode. And of course, if we haven't met before, welcome. I'm really glad you are here. I'm Pilar Ortiz. I'm the director of Virtual Not Distant, a company based in London where we help organizations make the transition to remote work or to a more office optional approach. And you can find out everything we do, which involves training, coaching, facilitation, consultancy, a blend of all of that, over at virtualnotdistant.com, where you can also find loads of articles. We just have so much content now. And of course, the show notes, the extended show notes for each episode. So virtualnotdistant.com. And of course, if you are a regular listener, welcome back. It's great that you are still here. There really are so many podcasts coming up. So I really appreciate your time. And if you're a regular listener, and in fact, if you're a new listener also, or if you're just popping in and out every now and then into this feed, then do fill in our podcast survey, because we are looking to find out what you are enjoying most from the new format. And indeed, if this new format is something that you're enjoying more than our old format, and it's just nice to hear what you think, you can find that survey over at virtualnotdistant.com/hello. Just a little bit of introduction to the conversation I had with Robert, which I actually had, I think it was back in June, and I am now recording this late August, so this often happens. And it was the day after Robert had been named number two of Glassdoor's top CEO of small and medium companies in the US. So it was really nice, and it's lovely for me to be talking to him on a day like that, because, well, you will hear the joy in his voice also. And I really, really enjoyed talking to him. So yes, they are a distributed company, but slightly different to what we sometimes think of as distributed. But he explains what that is. It's a really interesting location setup. And he talks about how by being intentional and careful about the things they do in the company, like onboarding, how it can actually be a better experience than in the co-located space, where a lot of the time we leave quite a bit of things to chance. This is usually the main problem when transitioning to remote, is stuff that's been just magically happen because we are in the space together most of the time need to be more deliberately introduced. But actually, sometimes we should be doing that regardless of whether we're co-located or distributed. So really interesting that to hear him thinking and explaining that approach. I was particularly interested in the onboarding process, how the values, the explicit values, are used in the company during hiring, and also in check-ins, in awards, in promotion. And in order to be able to use their values for all of that, they have only three. So very interesting how to be clear about core values and how to know whether people are embodying them. So yeah, I loved it because we went into quite a lot of detail around this. So if this interests you, I think, you'll get a lot from it. And of course, he also talks about his own personal values. So yeah, I leave you now with my conversation with Robert. And after that, I'll come back for my conversation with Maya. Listeners, in today's work-life segment, I am absolutely delighted to be talking to Robert Glaser, founder and CEO of Acceleration Partners. And Robert, congratulations.
Thank you.
Because Robert has just only yesterday, we are recording on the 21st of June, I think it is today, 2018, he was named number two of Glassdoor's top CEO of small and medium companies in the US. Well, congratulations. And how does it feel?
It feels good. It was a little bit of a crazy day, but it was really nice. I heard from a lot of people, and I think it was exciting for our team as well. I think it's really a reflection of our culture and the team that we have built as much as anything.
Yeah, and the video that your employees made, that the team members made for you, is absolutely, I mean, I was almost in tears watching it.
Yeah, they conned me onto a conference call, a video call that I was like, I don't understand, why do I have to be on this call to talk about this thing? And then they made me all watch it in front of them on Zoom with me watching it. So it was a lot of pressure.
Tell us a bit about the company then, and how, well, it's fully distributed, isn't it?
Yeah, and we actually use that. I like the word distributed, I think, more than virtual, because I think that has some connotations. But Acceleration Partners, we're a independent performance marketing agency that runs large-scale affiliate marketing programs. I think we're definitely the largest in the U.S., and we may be the largest in the world in terms of a fully independent agency with that focus. And we help large brands build a lot of online partnerships digitally and pay people on a performance basis. So if a retailer wants to work with lots of bloggers and coupon sites and only pay them marketing after they get a sale through a commission, we set up and manage those programs.
Mm-hmm. So are people employees, or are they contractors? The way you're describing it seems a bit of both.
Yeah, no, everyone is an employee. That's a big difference. And we have, we work with a what's called a PEO, which I don't know that they have them in Europe, but it's sort of an organization that wraps up a lot of smaller organizations, so you can get larger company benefits. So we have full benefits. Everyone's an employee. And we also hire around what we call hubs. So 80% of our people are in these sort of city areas, so that facilitates social interaction and hiring and us being able to visit a city and meet up with a team. We are client service business. So most people work within their client service team and are out at clients and visiting them and working with them. So there's a lot more interaction than I think people would realize. Both, we tend to use video as the default for anything, but I am always at a conference, visiting a client, being with team members. It's just, we go to them rather than they come to us. And that's both a function of the industry that we're in and where the talent is. And I think people outside the US, I've seen a lot of companies from Europe come to US and sort of fail to understand the geography on how how wide it is from side to side. So, our clients are all over the U.S. and global. So there's not a logical place for us to be where people would come to us.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying, if I understand correctly, through these hubs of people and by being remote, you're able to actually be co-located with clients? Did I understand that right? Or
not? No, close. Nope. I think you merged two things, but I was probably confusing. So the hubs allow the teams in those cities to get together and to do charity and social and interview. I actually think I've been talking a lot about this lately with some other virtual CEOs. And I think they see this, particularly if you're really trying to build a world-class culture. Hiring everywhere is really hard, because recruiting is not an everywhere-based thing. Recruiting is how many cities you want to pay for, look in this market. So we recruit by the city, and then people in those cities do the final round interviews. We actually think that the in-person interviews are critical. There's definitely some social and thing. Well, I think video is really good, and we use it for our earlier rounds. There's definitely stuff that has come out socially in final round interviews in person. So that allows us to do that. It also allows, like, our president a couple months ago went around, visited all the hub cities, met with almost every employee in the company within 2 weeks by traveling to the city. So we like that approach. People are happy to not, deal in traffic on a day-to-day, and there's lifestyle things that make that work for them. But that's one aspect. And then the other aspect, they are often traveling to our clients wherever they are. So there might be a group with people from Chicago and Denver all out in San Francisco together for a week and visiting some clients, or Los Angeles or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So it really feels like you're really making the best use out of the distributed setup and the co-located setup, and just using it in whatever way fits the best the business and the employees.
Yeah, and there's business reasons. happens. I mean, the cities in which our clients are located in, the talent is much more expensive and competitive, and we've been able, with the cities we're targeting, there's a lot more talent, lets us train and coach up people and then have those people work on programs. We're able to match up the supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. And so it really feels like, well, and also from the video and from the fact that Acceleration Partners has been named number 4 on Glassdoor's Best Place to Work list last year in 2017, amongst many others. And yet the setup is essentially distributed. How have you gone about building that feeling that there is a company culture, that there is a very strong identity for being an employee of this company?
Very intentionally. I think a lot of people perceive that any type of person would work in this environment. I think the one thing that I try to debunk is that we have spent 10 years building an interview process and screening for people that excel in this environment. And it's probably 1% of the people that we interview. So it doesn't work for anyone, but it also forces you to be intentional, you know, around certain things. There are a lot of pros and cons. I mean, I think the open workplace is actually being very debunked right now scientifically as being not productive and highly distractive, you know, to have everyone kind of in a bullpen all day long. Mm. We all really enjoy our mornings when we tend to synchronize our kind of 3 hours and everyone's, we call it GSD time, which is get stuff done. That's the PG version. And everyone puts their head down and works for 3 hours. And then they tend to do more meetings in the afternoon. So there is some intentionality around that, around the core values, around the right type of person for that. But for instance, onboarding and training is an area that we know it actually, I think, forces us to be intentional and better than things happening by accident. So we know that training is harder virtually. You lose some of the osmosis. And so we build these comprehensive training plans for people where their first 2 weeks are completely scripted out. They're on calls, they're shadowing, they're reading things, that we've built a whole learning management system that we're rolling out now. So I think we actually, it forces us to do things carefully that a lot of companies would leave to chance.
Yeah. And can you tell us, would you mind going a little bit more into detail about this last point? Because it's something that I think is a great worry of people making the transition to remote, that a lot of the learning, and we're not talking just the very technical training and making sure that people stay on top of their skills, but also all the social learning and also learning from each other, etc., and all the different ways in which we can learn together and individually. Can you tell us a little bit more? You were talking about the podcast that your company produces, for example, being integrated in some way into the learning management system?
Yeah, so we're trying to get multimedia in terms of, depending on the role, what are things people can read? What are things that they can watch? What are things they can listen to? So we've built modules, and we've taken, as we create content and assets and things get better than other things, they go into this learning management system. And then there's actually like a quiz at the end, and it monitors that you watched it. So it is sort of, I guess it's equivalent to allow some of the, you know, the online universities work in terms of, you know, everything is available, but we have to make sure you did it. And there's a proficiency thing. And again, we really script out those first few weeks of someone joining and saying, here's what the first day is going to look like. You're going to get trained on this and the core values. And I do an hour, and then you're going to have your tech meeting, and then you're going to shadow 2 or 3 meetings. And then, so we there's not a, you know, a lot of people come to work and they show up on their first day and it's like, nothing's planned for them. Yeah. In this way, it forces us to really plan out. I mean, I'm working on my first plan in about 10 years because it's a senior hire in an area that I focus on. And, you know, we're scripting out the entire first 2 weeks for this person because, you know, it does have to be more intentional. You can't, I mean, you might not be doing anything in office, but you'd sit around and you might listen and you have to be scheduled into those things, but it does require us to be thoughtful about that.
Mm-hmm. And so going going beyond the onboarding, you have some very strong, if I understand correctly, some very strong core principles, which I imagine influence how you recruit, but also, of course, how you lead. Yeah. And I'm interested in saying, because you've been around since 2006, have they evolved? How intentional have you been with these core principles?
Yeah, you know, every time I had a lot of founders and people in peer groups tell me the same thing, which is every time your company doubles in size, sort of half your people and half your systems break. Right. And I think that's true. So we did, we had the same core, and you know, I'm a founder that likes to tinker with things. So we had 6 or 7 core values. We really liked them. I think 2 or 3 years ago, we sat down and we were sort of laying out our plan for the next few years. And we were a little frustrated with some things that seemed to be straying. And I spent a couple months sort of writing this thing called the Vivid Vision for 2020 and really thinking about the core values. I also got some advice from some great companies that you really should have 3 or 4 max, and they should be simpler. And if you wanted everyone to know them. So I was kicking and screaming because we liked our core values, but we actually cut them down from 7 to 3. And it has been the best thing that we did because we use them. We don't use them as marketing slogans. We use them as the measurement of the DNA of someone who is successful in our environment. And what we found with 6 or 7 is that you say, oh, well, Pilar's like kind of 6 out of 7, or this person, so, you know, and now like you have to be 3 out of 3, like 2 out of 3 is a failing grade. And it's, you're expected to remember 3. You don't need a card. You don't need an acronym. If you know, if you can't remember, own it, excel and improve and embrace relationships, then we have a problem. But we use them everywhere. So we use them in hiring. It's a big, our hiring is sort of based on values and competencies. And we stress both equally. We use them in our weekly call shout outs. We use them in our check-ins, our end of year awards, or the core value awards. We highlight them in promotions. So people are really clear that those are the things that we value. And I think it attracts the right people. And honestly, the people who, I think one of the things about core values, they always sound good to people, but I say there's a real difference between them sounding good and you being them. And I think when people realize they aren't them, they tend to opt out on their own. One of the changes that we made, I'll give you an example, was we had this core value of accountability. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people that were really accountable. But as we grew and got past that sort of 5 million revenue level, and we needed people to specialize, we found that there were some people who really wanted to be accountable for inputs, not outputs. They wanted to say, look, I put the 14 hours into this, and I did the hard work, and it didn't work out. And they liked, and this is, I think this is an evolution of the company, they liked firefighting and playing a lot of different roles because that's what we valued early on. So your culture is what you value, and that's what we rewarded. And we really sat down and we said, this isn't what we want. We want people who own it. And they take responsibility. They say, I got it. They take the good and the bad and the unknown. You know, a salesperson never knows where all of their sales are going to come from in a year. If you sat down with them and tried to say, well, how exactly are you going to get every sale? And that's what we needed. So that was a good example where we had this core value of accountability. We didn't really change it, but we merged some, I think made them cleaner. And then we wrote some definitions of what own it really looks like. And own it says you take the good and the bad, you take the unknown with the known, you're just the type of person that owns it. And I think when we did that, that became really clear what we meant by that core value.
Mm-hmm. And so just a couple more questions about this. So you're saying, how do you, when you're recruiting, when you're looking at measuring or however you're looking at how the potential recruits are embodying the values,
yep.
How do you do that?
We have a series of behavioral-based questions for each core value. And on the recommendation of one of our coaches, we also have a scoring system for what a good answer sounds like and what a good answer does not sound like. So for example, on embrace relationships, there's some things that we can see just even from the resume and the discussion. Yeah. Are you always getting jobs on Craigslist, or were you pulled into your job, you know, 3 times in a row by former employees, right? That's someone clearly who's made good relationships in all their work. So there's questions, and the interviewers in each round can choose from those questions, and then we give them scoring. Like, this is what a 10 answer sounds like, and this is what a 1 answer sound like. I've really come to believe that recruiting is about a process and we've adopted the WHO system from Jeff Smart. It's really about a process that's consistent with multiple checks and balances, rather than you getting all caught up about your clever or voodoo question that may or may not actually have any predictive value of the success of an employee.
Yeah. And then, so following that, then how are these values reflected in the day-to-day operations? So you're saying, for example, that they're very present in your weekly calls. How would that look like?
When we do our all company call, the second segment is actually a core value shout out segment, and we would read them off and we would say, Sarah, there's a core value shout out from Sarah to Sarah from Jimmy, and then I'd read what it was. We pull that out of a system we have called Tiny Pulse, where people can leave cheers with each other, or people kind of nominate and say, can you give a shout out to X on the call? So we're always highlighting those. And we really believe in alignment. We use a system called the Entrepreneurial Operating System, EOS. It's from the book Traction. The stuff is far more popular over here than in Europe that I've seen at this point. All the companies I know kind of run one of these systems, and it's just very aligned. So for instance, your check-in here, we would go over, how are you doing on the three core values? How are you doing on the five fundamental objectives of your role, which are listed on what we call our accountability chart? So, you know, very clear about the five most important things in your role. And then how did you do on your 3 to 4 quarterly rocks or to-dos that we set out? And so for us, we say, again, that removes a lot of the subjectivity on it and personality issues. If you're, you know, if you're killing the core values and you're doing everything in your job description that you're supposed to, and you got all your things done, like, you're a star player. It's really that straightforward. And if you're not and struggling in a bunch of those areas, then we know what to address. So it makes those check-ins much less subjective.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, how are you embodying and role modeling? Because there's a lot of intentionality. You said this right at the beginning, and there's intentionality in continuing to help people embody these values and to remind everyone what they are. It's very intentional the way you're describing it. And the video that we're referring to right at the beginning has almost everyone at some point says how you are role modeling for them. So taking these values, how are you making sure that you are role modeling or what are you doing around them personally?
Well, I think it's structural. So it seems so simple, but I think the key, it's hard, but simple. It's as simple and as hard as this. The key to sort of success in life and business is figuring out your personal core values and being consistent on decision-making on that. And if you're clear on your personal core values, your company's core values should look a lot like that. And then if you recruit people that match those values, then you are very aligned. Like, you should be behaving in a way that everyone and sees and feels consistent. So one of the things that I have not given up and I still do is I do a core value and vision call with every group of new employees every 2 weeks. So I do that call within an hour. So in their first week, they get on a video call for an hour with me. I walk through them. I walk through why we created them, why they're important, how we use them, answer questions, and really establish that from the baseline. Also, when I'm shouting out to people or giving cheers, I often, you know, reference a core value. I sort of help on the awards at the end of the year, but those are things that are just naturally important to me. And if you find people that they're also important to them, and that's why the hiring is so critical, that you just have everyone on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And then I think finally, unless something else, it's always finally until something else pops up. Something I noticed also in the video your employees made was that there were a lot of personal stories and personal conversations you'd had with them. So just to give us a little bit of more context, how many employees are you working with at the moment, and how are you managing to develop these? I don't know. And how many of these, how many personal relationships do you have as in deep professional relationships, and how do you build those?
I try to have as many as I can. Obviously, when you start to get the size, I tend to know the newer people less, but I'm trying to work more on the business than in it. And as I release myself from being in the business, it lets me do deep dives and work with teams. I think what a lot of people were referring to was our theme for our summit last year was one of our core values, which was excel and improve. And I sort of put out all of my personal and professional goals for the year and encouraged other people to do the same in a Slack channel we had. And we got this incredible outpouring of people laying out their goals and setting standards for themselves. And I offered to work with anyone on their personal or their life goals. And I do that on Friday afternoons, and people can schedule an hour to chat with me on the phone. And I always tell people, you have to put it out there. Some of the things that they want to do, I might know the person, I have a resource. So I have tried to jump in one-on-one where anyone is willing to do that. But in general, a big part of our culture too is this concept of capacity building. And I think that people perform well when they get out of their comfort zone, do new things, and treat the person holistically from personal and professional lives. So we have coming out of that, we have a bunch of people running marathons and triathlons and doing a lot of things for the first time this year. And those people are actually performing really well in their jobs. So I try to encourage that. I constantly try to push myself out of my comfort zone and sign up for crazy things and demonstrate that to everyone that, hey, look, I didn't possibly think I could bike from London to Paris, but I've signed up to do that in the fall and I'm going to tell you how that goes, for better or for worse.
So. So there's a real fear at the moment, I think, because technology is taking on so many areas of our work that we are starting to forget about the humanity behind the people in the business. And it sounds like you're really very consciously making sure that in your business, we do not forget that these people are well-rounded humans with who do lots of other stuff, whose strengths and fears go beyond what they do at work.
Yeah, this is the whole subject of my second book, which is based on some of the Friday Forward stuff that I write and this concept of capacity building. And I believe in a growth company, when we're growing 30 or 40% a year, people need to grow their capacity to keep up with that about the same. And it's not about saying, hey, work harder and work more. I've built this model and it's really, there's spiritual, cognitive, physical, and then emotional capacities. Mm-hmm. And I think they are holistic. Like, I have not met someone who is just totally stressed in a basket case in their personal life and is working and is doing great in their work life, or yeah, has, you know, can't figure out balance at home and can figure out balance at work. So we're constantly training around life skills and general skills that I think someone says, oh, you know, working at this company, I've become healthier, a better mother or father, I'm performing my best. And really, I think those things all go hand in hand. And that's been one of our, I think, differentiators, or something I've honed into from a leadership standpoint, is like, we're going to focus on just making people better overall. I'm not going to worry about whether it's work or home or whatever. We're going to work on leadership and health and stress and all these things. And I'm willing to bet that we will see performance go up across the board. I actually did a shout out for someone on a call yesterday who started with us last year, signed up for a massive goal of completing a half Ironman. We got her a coach as one of our wish. She put it out there saying she wanted to do this, and we granted a bunch of these goals as part of our summit as a surprise. Mm-hmm. And she's getting close to doing this half Ironman, is training 3 hours a day and is really hitting her professional peak in our organization and doing incredibly well. And I have no reservations that those two things go hand in hand.
That's absolutely amazing. And is there anything else that you envisage having to think through again as you continue growing, or actually you're very much on the path of continuing with this this route of developing the whole person and really hiring to values? And you said you had a new person in place soon. Just curious about, as you continue to grow, what you think you might need to shift or not.
No, we're not going to shift anything on the values. I think how we deliver it, and people are worried about it, but I've said that my goal and my challenge is how to keep scaling that through new ways. I think one of the natural challenges is just communication. And with so many different people in groups, what is the right? I know there's some people, I just did on a call, I sort of showed this to people, like the light of the path of a flashlight, and the size of the organization, how much you see on a day-to-day basis as it grows. I said, look, I know a lot of you feel like you're being left out of stuff, but you, this is just the reality of a 100-person organization versus 50. There's so much stuff that I don't know about and can't know about. So, because if we communicated everything, no one would be able to differentiate signal from noise. So I think the culture shouldn't change. We do the same thing to find the same people. I think of it more as like the military or the Navy SEALs. Most of where you spend, you know, you train as an organization, you have your ethos, but you spend a lot of your time with your platoon. And basically, we just keep adding more platoons, but each platoon has the same DNA. Mm-hmm. I think the communication structures are what needs to involve the most as a company grows, to figure out what's the right amount, what's too much. That is something that we're constantly playing around with. And we, as I said to someone recently, they said, do you ever feel like you've got it mastered? And I said, well, if you're trying to grow 20% a year, you're always moving the goal. So I don't think you ever have it mastered. You're figuring out one thing and breaking another thing.
Wonderful. So finally, listeners, if you want to find out more about Acceleration Partners, it's accelerationpartners.com. There is a blog. They also have a podcast. We'll put a link to that. Robert, anything else that listeners who want to find out more about you, anywhere else they should go?
Yeah, if you want my weekly newsletter that goes out to about 40,000 people across the world now, you can go to Friday. It's actually FridayFWD.com, or just Google Friday Forward. And if you want to find all of my stuff in one place and speaking info and otherwise, that's just at robertglazer.com.
Excellent. We'll put those links out. And this book you were talking about, does it have a title yet? Are you writing it?
It's done.
Oh, it's done.
I am talking to some publishers and trying to figure out which way I want to release it. The working title is Outperform, and it's Excellent. The subtitle is Building Capacity in Yourself and Others.
Wonderful. Well, I'm glad that you said that it's not published yet, because I was going to say, where is it? I haven't seen it yet. Excellent. Well, hopefully once it's out there, you will come back and talk to us as a voice behind the book segment.
I'd love to.
Well, thank you very much. And absolute congratulations again on the Glassdoor CEO wonderful award.
Thank you, Pilar.
Well, thank you, Robert Glazer, for going into so much detail. And I hope, listeners, that you enjoyed that as much as I did. As much as I did during the interview itself, and then later on listening again to it, because we did record back in June, more than 2 months ago. So I did need to go back to it to refresh my memory. And I really enjoyed listening back. So if you felt that what Robert was saying is very much in line with how you see life and work and leading others, then do sign up to his newsletter, which I'll just remind you is over at Friday and then FWD for forward. So FridayFWD.com, or just look for Friday Forward online. I do think you'll enjoy it. I just signed up and got a lovely thank you message. I really liked it for signing up. More inspiring than the one we are sending out. So I think we need to revisit that. We also have a newsletter. It doesn't go out as often as Robert's, and it's more of a digest of content, of our own stuff, but also stuff that we come across. And you can sign up to that over at virtualnotdistant.com. So, as I said in the introduction, we have one other segment today. And in this segment, Maya and I look at a range of initiatives that are going on around the world to try and change the traditional 8 hours a day, 5 days a week setup. And the reasons for that, it's not just all, let's just change it for sake of that. It's because there is a feeling at the moment that people are working too long hours. They're working very long hours, and that's not good for the health of the individual and, of course, the companies and, of course, therefore, of the country. So if you want to read the articles before we start, then have a look at the show notes, which you can access by tapping on the artwork if you're listening to this on an app, or by going over to virtualnotdistant.com, the podcast page, and this is episode 179. So if you want to do that before the conversation between Maya Middlemiss, who is my colleague over at Virtual Not Distant, and myself, then, okay, here we go. Maya, it's been a while since we got in front of the microphones to talk about an article or two.
Well, it's been a long, hot summer, but there's been plenty to read and catch up on.
Yeah, so I've recently come across quite a few of these articles, and I thought, okay, is something happening, or maybe I'm just more receptive to it? And these were all articles about experiments that are going on in different parts of the world, which are aiming to reduce working hours. And the aim of reducing those working hours is to reduce work stress or to give people more of a choice of how they lead their lives. So, yes, any immediate thoughts before we start to talk about the different articles?
I suppose my first reaction to these was, maybe I've been freelancing for too long, but the fact that it still seems so big of a deal to mess with the expected 9 to 5, Monday to Friday week, that it's still regarded as radical experimentation to adjust this even slightly in so many different industries. That it's great to see that people are flexing it and trying out different combinations. There's just a slight sadness that this is still deemed really revolutionary.
Yeah, I think you're right. I hadn't thought of that. I was just excited to read the stuff. But I think you're right. And in some cases, there being experiments that are not being picked up on. So anyway, shall we start with... Let's start with Japan, which which I know nothing about. So I found an article, and then I also found a snippet in a magazine. So there is this article that was featured in The Guardian beginning of August. So we are we're recording on end of August 2018, and this article was from the 3rd of August, and it's called, I'll give you the title, listeners, in case you want to Google it, Japan Urges Overworked Employees to Take Monday Mornings Off. And essentially, for listeners, what this article is about is, I had some notes and now I've left them somewhere else.
It looks like that it's a scheme to suggest that people come in later on Mondays. And I love the name Shining Mondays for this idea of being able to start late. But they're talking about one day a month when you get to come in at lunchtime on Mondays.
I forgot about that.
I mean, I think it just underlines the very long hours work culture that is part of Japanese business, clearly. The fact that one lie in a month is deemed really radical.
That's it. I did read that, but I didn't clock it. It didn't stay in my brain that it was once a month, not every Monday. And it's, they call them Shining Mondays.
I like the name.
It's really nice. And yes, and it's all about the fact that they can arrive after lunch if they want to. And this is an initiative by the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry. So it's at government level. And I think they were saying it's in the ministry where they were trying it out, I think.
Yes, I think so. So it's whether that carries over into private business or not. I suppose that will be based on whether it's deemed to have been a successful experiment or not. And it looks like the jury's still out on that. And the article does reference the fact that Japan has extremely long hours working culture, and the fact that there have even there's a Japanese word for death by overwork. People just getting so burned out that they take their own lives. And in fact, even The Guardian has deemed it necessary to put in suicide prevention helplines at the bottom of this article, suggests that they think this is not just a localized phenomenon either.
That is scary. The name is Karoshi. I don't speak Japanese. So you were saying about whether the Shining Mondays are going to be taken up. And there is something else that they tried to, well, that they actually started, which was Premium Fridays, which is, it's very similar. Instead of arriving early, you clock off early to spend more time with families. So that was one of the aims, was that you could leave to spend more time with families or to boost spending.
Yes, go and be economically active.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That the government can think about it holistically and can think, okay, well, if this happens here, this happens here. But Premium Fridays were only taken up by 11.2% of companies. Yeah. Back to your point.
I mean, that really addresses the fact that you can't change culture just by putting something structural in like that. It doesn't change the way that organizations work, the way people feel about how they have to show up and the work that they're doing. And also, I think the whole idea of adding on that, it's like saying at the end of the month, any money that you've got left, put it in a savings account or something. I mean, Friday afternoons, if you have this culture of never having enough time to get your work done, it's simply not going to work to say knock off early.
Yeah, exactly. And also, so it's really interesting what you're saying about initiatives and culture and how things are viewed. So in People Management, which is the CIPD magazine, which is Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development in the UK, there was this is what started thinking, this is what got me started thinking about all this. There's a little snippet, which I'm going to just read the whole of it, about an anecdote in a Japanese company. So a Japanese employee has been fined half a day's pay after leaving for lunch 3 minutes early. The worker, employed at the Waterworks Bureau in the city of Kobe, committed the offense on 26 occasions over 6 months, violating the law that requires staff to concentrate on their jobs, according to his employer. Japan has some of the longest working hours in the world, with hundreds of deaths a year related to overwork. The man had taken just 55 hours leave in 6 months. So... Oh. It's interesting. I mean, at the same time, I'm reading it again and thinking, okay, so he's a serial offender of whatever, however much we might think that the rules are not fair from our point of view. So I suppose we need to take that into account. But still, it's very strict.
It is incredibly strict. And, you know, we think of the kind of environments in the UK, we think about call centres and places like that where people are very heavily monitored as to whether you're logged on or logged off and being productive and having toilet breaks timed and things like that and people being penalised. And we see that as happening to some of the poorest paid workers. And we talk about white collar factories, whereas it does suggest from this article that this is quite culturally normal in far more senior roles to be scrutinised and monitored that much. I suppose, again, it just reflects a culture that's very different to the one that we expect in the UK, and maybe anything can become normal, but it feels incredibly high pressure to me.
Yeah, and yes, and like you said, so it's very interesting to see those experiments like Shining Mondays being introduced. One final thing I have to say about Japan. So there was a Eurofund study in 2017, Work From Anywhere, which looked at 15 different countries and the effect of mobile working and how different governments and different countries were adopting it or not. And it's really interesting that it said that, and I'm going to quote again, that in Japan, technology mediated work is promoted mainly as a tool to combat the erosion of the labor force. Declining birth rates paired with an aging population and low employment rates among women have led to a decline in labor force participation over the last two decades. So it's really, yeah, it's really interesting that in some Western countries, it's being introduced as a flexible thing, if that's a terrible expression, to give you. And actually, in Japan, it's got a much broader agenda.
I suppose it's a reminder to all of us when we're working, whether locally or in cross-cultural remote teams and so on, just to be aware that the different factors impacting work-life culture can vary so much more than we might think about every day.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, anything else to say about this little collection that we just scuffled?
No, I think it'll be very interesting to see how this pans out and all these different cultural factors combine and whether it will look very different in Japan in 5 years or 10 years. But I hope everybody will manage to survive until then.
Yeah, it's very scary. Good. So we're going to the very near Japan, very nearish, nearish, to Australia. Nearish is nearer than I am. And we have the opposite kind of approach where, and this was also something that I saw in a People Management magazine. And this was an experiment where people were able to leave before 1 o'clock during the day. But they were still being paid for the whole day. So this is a company in Australia that, I'll just tell you the name of the company in case you're interested. They're a wealth firm. They're called Collins SBA. And yeah, so they're saying as long as KPIs are met, staff are free to leave after 5 hours of work. And this is really interesting because when I've talked in the past to some people who were like, oh, I'd love to work less hours, that, and I said, well, you know, see if they can let you go to 4 hours a day. And they always say, oh, no, but I wouldn't want to lose one day's pay. And so it's really interesting and very, I think it's really very, you know, chapeau. Take my hat off to the company that has said, actually, we believe in this so much that we are willing to continue paying you for this, but you can leave at 1 o'clock.
And to say we believe in you and your self-management, that you can get your work done more productively and effectively with greater autonomy over how you spend your time. I think there are so few jobs nowadays that actually require a certain amount of presence over specific hours This is like one more hang up from the industrial age where people had to be on a production line in a factory or something, clocked in or out of a building for a specific time. Most of our work simply isn't like that now. And if you can work better in short bursts of more productive concentration, you waste less time because you know you're free to leave as soon as your work is done, then I'm sure that's got to be far more optimally productive.
Yes, my cousin in Spain, actually, which is very rare, he was working for a small solicitor's firm, and they did this. The owner said, okay, we're going to start. It wasn't 1 o'clock, it was 3 o'clock, but that for a long Spanish day where you usually work into the evening.
You don't have to come
very
back
good.
In the evening.
That's yeah, great. That's one. Yeah, and you don't have that 2 hour lunch break either. So you start, I don't know if they started at 8:30 and then finish at 3:00. And he said they were all so happy with it and that the results were the same.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. Yeah.
I think people can be so much more. I mean, it's like if you're about to go on a business trip or a holiday, you find that last day in the office is really productive because you're just smashing through all of those stayers on your list that you just want to get the decks cleared and out the door. And if you can bring that same feeling to every day because you know you can just leave once you're done, then I think you'd simply be more productive and that momentum will carry over into the results you achieve as well.
Yeah, that's really good. And then very near Australia, over in New Zealand, there's another experiment reported. And this is reported in sciencealert.com. And in case you want to Google it, Maya will put all the links
we'll
to the,
it all in the show notes,
articles. Yeah. But in case you want to Google it as we are going along, not if you're driving, this 4-day work week experiment went so well, the company is keeping it. And this is from the 23rd of July, 2018. So just very quickly, the company, it's a trusts firm, Perpetual Guardian, and they have 240 employees. And what they did during March and April, they were able to work only for 4 days a week, but they were still being paid 5. So what's happened now? So some of the things they report is stress levels. So staff stress level. Very important. This is that they also commissioned an independent survey from researchers at the University of Auckland and Auckland University of Technology to look at this. So it wasn't just them, and it wasn't just what was being reported by staff. So there was an independent survey. So they indicated staff stress levels fell from 45% to 38%. So I suppose now that I'm looking back at it, it's not that huge, but it's something.
It's measurable though. If that is independently benchmarked rather than just them asking internally, then that's even more valid.
Yes. And then I don't know what this means. While work-life balance improved from 54% to 78%, that's a huge increment.
Yeah.
I don't
know.
It's not
clear in the article how they measured that.
And yeah, because it improved. What does that mean? Yeah. So I can imagine that people were happier with their work-life balance, whatever that meant. So anyway. Something
I'm sure
good
that
happened.
Most people, if you ask them, did you prefer it when you worked for 5 days? Or do you have a better work-life balance now? You have a 3-day weekend. I think it would be very unusual for someone to answer that their work-life balance was better when they had less time. There might be other negatives to it in terms of how they feel they're getting their work done, which the research obviously also explored, but certainly if the business feels that they're just as productive, in fact, the survey data showed a marginal increase across most teams for job performance. So that shows that the more you work in a more focused way, perhaps the more you get done. And if Thursday evenings becomes Friday evenings of let's just clear the decks, I know I'm not going to be back here for 3 whole days. So perhaps I need to get my inbox even clearer.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because it'd be interesting to see how this pans out in the long term, because 2 months is not very long.
There'd still be a novelty effect there.
Yes. And so you would expect, I was thinking, how would I feel? Well, of course, engagement is going to increase because this is your own, the buzz in the company. You must have really been able to feel this, the buzz of, okay, we're doing something different. Mm. We're being trusted. Oh my God.
Yeah.
We're being trusted so much. We're trying something. We're doing something different. We are so, there's so much we're so liked. I don't know what's happening with my language today. Our bosses like us so much that, we're appreciated so much that they're doing this for you. And I think it's really, it's really good. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the long term.
I agree. I think there are so many things that we think of as motivators within the workforce, within the workplace, but how much they endure is something that's not often measured and compared against. And if once that becomes your normal, then I suppose you become like a freelancer, that you know that your effort is correlated with your reward. And it becomes the new normal to do 4 days a week and to be that productive and to have that expectation. So in a year's time, it would be great to follow this up. I wonder if they will.
Yes, I hope so. I hope so. And I was also thinking what happens when people who join the business, when this is already taking place. And that will be really interesting to see how people who join the business who are used to a different schedule, how they manage to adapt to this. So, which brings us to, as if by magic, as if we'd planned this, it leads us to what's been going on in Sweden, which I remember. I've now been in the space long enough, which is only actually a few years. It's not that long, but I've been looking at this stuff long enough that I remember when this experiment started and how everyone was really looking at Sweden, who were bringing down the day in certain places down to 6 hours of work a day rather than eight. Sorry, my iPad's crashed so that it's not pulling up the article, which is not great.
Well, the article's from last year.
Yes, 8th of February.
2017, and it was BBC News, so interesting to see that take on it compared to the British situation, I suppose. But a six-hour day, again, is that really so radical if you get your work done within 6 hours?
Well, they were looking quite specifically at the company was a healthcare, so they were actually looking at nurses reducing their day from 8 hours to six. So
and totally fair enough. That is one profession where you need to be physically present. You need to be. You can't be a remote care worker, and you can't be a condensed hours care worker. They're going to have to cover those shifts with minimum staff to patient ratios, presumably.
Well, that's a thing also that they had to bring. If one nurse only does 6 hours, who's going to do the other two?
Yeah.
So that involved a cost also, which I think is really, it's really important, because that this is the thing when you're looking at different industries, you have to be so careful with what the effects are of these things. So in this particular, there was one of the companies that that took on this. It was a Svartedalens elderly care home in Gothenburg.
Very good.
And yeah, well, I did Gothenburg quite well. I'm not sure about the other. My Swedish is not great. Yeah. So what they did find in that place was that doing the shorter hours meant there was less sick leave. And one of the ways in which they saw productivity being boosted was that the nurses were being able to organize 85% more activities for patients. That's huge.
That's amazing, isn't it? And it does suggest that it reminds us that all of us, we might think of this as being specific to knowledge workers, but it isn't. We do a lot of our thinking about our work outside of the hours that we're paid to do it. And we do a lot of the planning and preparation and then bring that back into the workplace where it benefits the work. So just giving people a bit more time to think and plan clearly had a lot of benefits for the end customers in this case.
Yeah, it was really good. Yes, I mean, there are all those benefits. People are more rested, especially in professions like nursing and care, which is so intense and you really need. But they're not sure in Sweden. I mean, this article doesn't really say very much. It brushes it quite broadly. Yeah. So anyone who has more insight into what's happened in Sweden, please, virtualnotdistant.com, please get in touch through the contact form there. But it really doesn't seem like it's going to be adopted in a lot of places, I think, by the feel of the article.
It's a bit inconclusive at the end. And also there are specific benefits reflected here, which really only apply to the public sector or the state sector, like creating 17 extra jobs in the city. That's simply not going to be a benefit for the private sector, who has no interest in creating those jobs. So somehow or other, they need to amplify the other benefits or measure them more objectively, because I think that 85% more activities is the most exciting statistic there.
Yeah, that's true.
They can offset that with things like reduced sick pay and staff turnover, then there might be able to be a business case somewhere within that that would be more broadly applicable. But the politician's conclusion seems to have been that, no, it's a bit too expensive to roll out on a long-term basis.
Yeah, and I was thinking, what was expensive about it? And I thought in cases like the home care and the nursing, that I suppose it's that extra... the extra cost of bringing someone else in.
Yeah, 17 new nurses, I guess, to cover. If they're paying them the same for a six-hour shift as they did for an eight-hour one, then, the city councillor said it was unfair to continue investing taxpayers' money in this pilot. But nurses and their patients are taxpayers too.
Yes, that's true. It's really interesting, because then looking at how this might work in different industries and different kinds of work. There's an anecdote in the article about a startup that tried to introduce something like this. And what happened was that they found that it was really stressful, because they were finding having to do in 6 hours the work they would normally do in eight, and stressing out about it, and it didn't work.
And maybe that's another reminder that people are so unique and individual. It's very, very difficult for a huge employer to address that. It's difficult for a small organization to address it. But to really trust people to have that much autonomy, to know how they work best. This is what we need from you in terms of output. How and when do you want to do it? Where do you want to do it? That can produce amazing results, but it takes such huge levels of trust and self-knowledge to really make it work. I can't see how it's going to work at a city council level.
Well, it depends, because one thing that they're saying is that this kind of setup might be better for places where you end work and that's it. Like care. Yes. You might be thinking about something that's happened during the day, blah, 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 but you can't actually continue to do the work. No. Whereas in any kind of setup where you can continue looking at your phone or working from home for a few minutes or whatever, or logging into the intranet from home to check something, that's where it actually might cause more problems, because then it becomes, well, I'm working 6 hours, but not really.
Except I'm really working 24 hours. Not the objective. And that's not going to address the issues that they're concerned about with illness and burnout and sick leave and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, listeners, this is a huge topic, which is why we thought, it fitted in quite well with the conversation with Robert Glaser, which is a little bit about culture. And this, we're also looking, I mean, this conversation with Maya was not only about culture, but it is about initiatives that are trying to change the culture in organizations and even at a country level. So it's quite interesting. And what I really liked is this article at the end of the BBC. They ask a consultant, it's a lead researcher. It's actually the lead research for the care home project we were talking about. And she's saying, well, we shouldn't start with the question of, should we reduce hours or not? It's what can we do to make the working environment better? And I feel it's great, because I feel a lot of the times people are thinking, oh, we should do this, we should do that. Yes, but hang on, have you asked? Have you asked people what they want, what helps them? And then have you asked again? Because the first, like we're seeing with the startup that they're talking about, the first thing might be actually, reduced hours would be great. But is that really what they want?
Yeah, if it just makes you feel stressed and that you're being judged for being unproductive in the time you're supposed to get your work done, then yeah.
So is that what people really want? And actually, or maybe people, you can ask them what they wouldn't want, or what's getting in the way, and then start from there. So anything else you want to say, Maya, before we clock off?
I'm going to punch out of the factory now. No, I just think it's really interesting how much of these assumptions still come from really a century or so ago. And it's important to question them every now and again. It's good to see that happening from startups to government level, that people are starting to ask those questions.
Excellent. And of course, we would love to talk about unlimited vacations, although I think we've talked about, we covered an article, and we'll have to dig out which episode that was in. So also, you might want to check out David Berker's book, Under New Management, where he actually covers 10 newish practices and really asks these kind of questions. Are these the kind of practices that would work in your organization? And he talks about examples where they worked and where they didn't. So really, really interesting read, Under New Management. And of course, virtualnotdistant.com for all your long form comments, and Virtual Teamwork with a zero instead of an O on Twitter. Well, listeners, thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We kept the focus narrow, but we tried to go into a little bit of depth during the conversations. If you have 5 more minutes, there is the survey out there on virtualnotdistant.com/hello. And any feedback that you want to send through, any suggestions for topics or guests, then over at virtualnotdistant.com, we have a long form contact form, or you can email me directly. Pilar@virtualnotdistant.com, and my name is spelled P-I-L-A-R. All right, you know the drill. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, enjoy.
Well, I was telling one of my friends how I did all these podcasts I did in my closet, and she looked at me like I had 4 heads with these authors, and she thought that people were coming into my closet. So it's funny.